Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Howard Zinn's History of the United States, provocatively titled A People's History, is now over 20 years old and it remains as controversial as ever. Some consider it brilliant, others political and troubling. In a moment, Talking History's Fred Nielsen will speak with Howard Zinn about the newly revised and updated edition of his history. But first, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. This week in history is usually remembered for D-Day, June 6, 1944, and the Allied invasion of Normandy. But June 4, 1940 marks another equally important date in this history of World War II, the evacuation of Allied troops from the French port of Dunkirk. Although the Dunkirk evacuation is often associated with defeat, the successful operation accomplished nothing less than snatching victory from the jaws of defeat. The German armies in the spring of 1940 had overrun Belgium, northeastern France, and Holland. The Allied armies were decisively beaten, and the fall of France was imminent. Hundreds of thousands of British, French, and Belgian soldiers, with their backs to the coast, encircled by German troops, faced certain capture and almost certain death. But beginning on May 26, 1940, an armada of nearly every conceivable type of floating vessel, ranging from small privately owned yachts and schooners to enormous barges and military transports, crossed the English Channel from Britain to rescue the Allied soldiers. Numbering between 850 to 950 vessels, the rescue mission, while under heavy German aerial bombardment, saved more than 338,000 men. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, 20 CIA files containing information on top Nazi war criminals have been revealed to the public as part of an initiative to search for Holocaust records under the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act. Among the declassified files is a record of Adolf Hitler's physician's observations about Hitler's mental state. He considered the Nazi leader to be a border case between genius and insanity, and predicted in 1937 that he would become the craziest criminal the world ever knew. Files of 19 other top Nazi leaders are also among those released. They revealed that during the early days of the Cold War, the U.S. government, particularly military intelligence, knowingly recruited Nazis accused of war crimes or espionage against the Soviet Union. At the time, historians say, the U.S. government believed the policy to be justified because of the perceived Soviet threat to the West. More than 25 years after the end of the Vietnam War, a group of American military brass gathered in Fallbrook, California, to declare victory over one of the war's most feared and controversial symbols, napalm. On a hilltop at the Naval Weapons Station, the acting Secretary of the Navy, admirals, and other personnel from the Defense Department announced that the final cache of liquid fire had been destroyed. Like the war itself, the push to dispose of more than 34,000 canisters of napalm was protracted and expensive, in the end costing $50 million. But the last 10-foot cigar-shaped canister has been punctured, drained, and shredded. This is Talking History. Treatment of heroes and their victims, the quiet acceptance of conquest and murder in the name of progress, is only one aspect of a certain approach to history in which the past is told from the point of view of governments, conquerors, and leaders. Thus writes our guest this week in one of the most controversial histories of the United States. Here to speak with that author is Talking History's Fred Nielsen.
Howard Zinn is not the typical historian. He believes that professors have obligations that should take them outside the classroom and library. While most historians preach the virtue of objectivity, Zinn freely acknowledges his biases, demanding that others acknowledge theirs. Few scholars have written with his clarity and passionate conviction. His book, A People's History of the United States, published 2 decades ago, has sold over 700,000 copies, making it one of the most widely read books by a professional historian. An audio version read by the actor Matt Damon appeared in 1999. Howard Zinn, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Most historians claim to strive for objectivity. By contrast, you've written that you've lost all desire for objectivity, whether in living your life or writing history. Why is objectivity undesirable?
Well, first of all, I think objectivity is impossible, despite all the claims that many historians have to be objective. Well, for that matter, many newspapermen have to be objective. Almost anybody who describes an event claims to be objective. But it's impossible because when you're doing history, you're dealing with an infinite amount of data concerning the past. Inevitably, you must select out of that. You can't present it all. There's too much. And so in your selection, you are guided by what you think is important. And what you think is important is based on your philosophy, your social views. One historian may think it's really important who wrote Andrew Jackson's second inaugural address. And I think it may be more important to talk about the My Lai massacre or to talk about Jackson's expulsion of the Indians from the Southeast. So I think objectivity is impossible because of the inevitability of selection. And I think it's undesirable because what I think you need to do is to focus on those things that happen in history that relates to problems that we have in the world today. And that means that you must, in a sense, take a stand as a historian. Take a stand in the sense that you believe in certain values. You believe that war is wrong. You believe that economic equality is a desirable thing. You believe that racial injustice is wrong. And I think when you have values like that, yes, you're not being objective. It doesn't mean that you are going to lie, distort, but it does mean that you are going to focus on the kind of issues that relate to the values that you have. And that makes history important, and not just a matter of putting down data which go nowhere.
What prompted you to write the People's History of the United States?
Well, I suppose it's because I was reading in my studies when I was a graduate student at Columbia and getting my doctorate, reading the texts of history and finding that they omitted enormously important events, which my life, you might say, had persuaded me were really significant. By that I mean my life as a sort of growing up in a working class community, getting interested in the history of working people and of labor, and reading on my own and reading about the great labor struggles in American history, you know, which finally succeeded in winning the 8-hour day, and the great clashes between workers and employers, and the government coming in on the side of the employers almost all the time. Now, these were very dramatic, important events, and I looked in my traditional history books for them. They weren't there. And so I had the same kind of feeling about the history of black people in this country. Especially when I began teaching in the South. My family and I moved south in 1956. I taught at a black women's college, at Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, for 7 years. I became involved in the Southern Civil Rights Movement and realized that the history of that movement really was being ignored to a large extent. Yes, a few very dramatic events were being reported, but so much was going on that simply was ignored. And then I looked into black history, looked into the history of black people in this country, and realized that so much of that history was not being told because our history books were being written, you know, mostly by white people from a white point of view, and black people were, you know, as Ralph Ellison put it in the title of his book, you know, invisible man, black people were invisible. And so I thought it important to make them visible. I had the same feeling about the history of Native Americans. So you learn history in school and you learn about the Custer's Last Stand, you learn a few things about the history of Native Americans, but you you don't really learn anything about, for instance, the great Indian removal of the 1830s, when thousands and thousands of Indians who lived in the southeastern part of the United States, in Georgia and Alabama, the Cherokees and the Creeks and the Seminoles and so on, what we call the five civilized tribes, when they were driven out of their homes by the American army, Jackson and then Buren as presidents, driven out, this something called the Trail of Tears, in which there's this great trek across to the Mississippi. 4,000 Indians died on that trek. All of that missing from the history books. So I wanted to write a book in which the history of the United States was told from points of view that had been ignored, from the point of view of black people, Native American people, working people, women. I even wanted to tell the story of American wars from the viewpoint of our enemies. In other words, tell a story, for instance, of the Mexican War from the standpoint of the Mexicans. That's something we don't get. We get the Alamo, and we get the triumphal stories of America winning its wars, including the Mexican War. But if you look at it from the standpoint of the Mexicans, it was a war instigated by the United States because the United States was covetous of the Mexican territory. In fact, the war ended with the United States taking almost half of Mexico, which is now the great southwestern part of the United States. So there was all of this that I thought was missing from traditional treatments of American history. And let me say just one more thing about that. I thought that the traditional look at American history, which looked at American history from the standpoint of our important people, the presidents, the founding fathers, the Supreme Court decisions, the acts of Congress, what that did was leaving out the actions of farmers and workers and black people, the struggles of ordinary people, that kind of history created a kind of passivity among its readers. It created the idea among all these young people studying history that history is made by important people. And I wanted to really get across the idea that ordinary people, when they organize and when they struggle for justice, play a very, very important part in our history.
Hence, an important word in the title is a people's history. It's not the leader's history. It's not Washington's or Lincoln's history.
Yes.
One of the words that turns up frequently in your people's history is the word control. And as I read the book, it seems to be a thread throughout. There are certainly aspects of control when writing about slavery. One might not be surprised at that. And yet, the word shows up at other places, too. In discussing the American Revolution, for example, you write that the founding fathers created, in your words, the most effective system of national control devised in modern times. Mm. And near the end, you write, the American system is the most ingenious system of control in world history. Could you elaborate on that, the theme of control in your book?
Yeah, it's interesting that you should pluck that out of various parts of my book, but you're right. That is an important theme in my book, and I suppose I emphasize that because we grow up sort of thinking that ours is a democratic country, that the people are in charge. I mean, that's what democracy is supposed to be, that it's a government, for the people. And in other countries, totalitarian countries, dictatorial countries, the people are controlled by the government and the army and so on. So we have this idea of this vast difference between these other countries where people are controlled and our country where people are in charge. And what I am saying as a result of looking at American history is that here, too, in this country, the people are not in charge. It is not a government of and by and for the people. The people who are in charge are the most powerful, the most wealthy people in the country. And it starts with the founding fathers when they set up a constitution that basically is set up for the purpose of maintaining order, maintaining control. The year before the Founding Fathers get together in Philadelphia in 1787, in the year 1786 in Massachusetts, there was a great rebellion of farmers, poor farmers rebelling against the rich who control the legislature of Massachusetts and taxing them heavily and taking away their farms when they can't pay their taxes. This Shays Rebellion takes place in western Massachusetts. It's a very tumultuous event. Things, you might say, things are out of control. It's finally suppressed, but the Founding Fathers are very disturbed by it, very worried. They want to set up a new national government that will maintain control, that will prevent things like Shays Rebellion from taking place. And that is a very powerful motive for them getting together in Philadelphia and setting up the Constitution. The idea of the Constitution, really, and remember, the Founding Fathers are mostly slave owners, merchants, people who hold bonds. They're the rich of the colonies. They worry about the rebellion of the poor. Now, they're very explicit about this. And so they set up a system of control. And it's a very sophisticated system of control because it's not like a totalitarian state, a military dictatorship where you simply control people by force. You control people by giving them some tokens of democracy. You let them have some popular participation. You let them vote. You put in a Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights may not mean much to people who are poor, and the Bill of Rights may be violated again and again by the government, but still you have a Bill of Rights, you vote, you have all the symbols of participation and democracy, but essentially, throughout American history, the country is fundamentally controlled by the people with the most wealth and the most power.
Your People's History is one of the few books that I can think of by a professional historian to appear in a Hollywood movie. Mm. It's mentioned in Good Will Hunting.
Mm.
Do you know how that came about?
Well, I'd like to say it came about out of the spontaneous enthusiasm of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck for my book. I guess maybe part of it was that they were enthusiastic about my book, but it's also true that Matt Damon has been a friend of my family. His mother has been a friend of my family. A very good friend of me and my wife for many, many years. They were our neighbors. And so we've known Matt Damon since he was 5 years old. He grew up next door, and his mother probably gave him a copy of The People's History when he was 10 years old. And then when he and Ben Affleck were in high school in Cambridge, their teacher used The People's History of the United States. And they obviously are fans of the book. And so when Fox Television was looking around for some stars to attach to a possible miniseries based on The People's History, well, it called upon them, having seen the line that they wrote in Good Will Hunting, a line that they put in, I guess, out of they wanted to say something nice about People's History, which they thought was important in developing their thinking about the world.
Mm-hmm.
Their mention of a book with Matt Damon's recommendation of that book in the scene with Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting gave the book a certain boost.
Your book, as I've said, has sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It's now on the big screen. But, of course, its main purpose is more serious than simply selling books or selling movie tickets. It seems to me that you're viewing history as a kind of moral enterprise. And I wonder, in closing, we have a minute or so left, what would you summarize as the purpose of history? Or to put it another way, why write it, why read it, why learn it? What is it good for?
I think the importance of history is to give us perspective on things that are happening today, so that we aren't captive by what people in authority tell us. We have no way of checking up on them. The president will tell us we have to go to war for freedom, for democracy, for this, for that. If we have no history, if we don't know the history of our wars and the futility of those wars, if we don't know the lies and deceptions that accompanied wars, if we don't know that history, then we will simply become passive recipients of whatever people in authority tell us. If we don't know the history of black people in this country, we'll sort of blithely say, well, what are they excited about, and why must we do something special for them? You know, if we don't know the history of women's struggles in this country, you know, we might not take seriously the idea of sexual equality. Yeah, so the idea of history, I think, is to put present-day problems in perspective and to teach us things that will make us skeptical of words that come from above, that will give us a kind of independent set of facts, an independent source of knowledge against which we can test what is happening today and what is told to us today.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Zinn, for visiting with us.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me.
We've been listening to Howard Zinn, author of numerous books and essays, including A People's History of the United States.
As historians, we seek to learn from the past, and many of those lessons only become clear to us by use of analogies. Occasionally, however, those analogies are ill-conceived and even dangerous. That's the subject of this week's op-ed, prepared for us by Michael Richards, professor of history at Sweetbriar College in Sweetbriar, Virginia.
Historical analogies, comparing something in the present with its counterpart in the past, are not created equal. Some are better, or at least more useful when it comes to seeking guidance from history. A case in point is the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. As 13 Days, the Kevin Costner movie on the crisis makes clear, the inappropriate use of historical analogies can lead to foreign policy disaster. 13 Days shows President John Kennedy and his advisors learning that the Soviet Union was installing medium-range nuclear missiles in Cuba. Their immediate response was to invoke the lessons of Munich. At the 1938 Munich conference, Britain and France failed to stand up to Hitler. Their attempt to buy him off with a portion of Czechoslovakia did not succeed. Appeasement did not prevent World War II. The lessons of Munich taught American policymakers that signs of weakness might lead to World War III. Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader who introduced nuclear missiles into Cuba, was no different than Hitler, according to this view. Seen from this perspective, the situation demanded a resolute response from the United States. The film, accurately depicting Kennedy's response to the crisis, helps us see that not every historical analogy is a useful one. We see in 13 Days the dilemma presented by the proposal, seemingly called for by the lessons of Munich, to launch airstrikes on the missile sites. Military advisors conceded the airstrikes would probably not destroy all the missiles and would require a follow-up invasion of Cuba. This raised the possibility of Soviet retaliation elsewhere, and even the chance of a nuclear exchange. In 13 Days, Kennedy mentions having recently read Barbara Tuchman's book on the opening days of World War I, The Guns of August. In fact, the Tuchman book did influence Kennedy's thinking in the missile crisis. He was struck by the way European leaders were boxed in by military plans and by what they assumed the other side intended. The result was a war that cost millions of lives. It seemed to him the United States now stood before just such a moment, and that the appropriate analogy was not Munich, but the origins of World War I. In the presidency of George Bush, it will be necessary for him to make difficult decisions in matters of foreign policy. Whenever he faces such a decision, President Bush should not assume that a historical analogy will automatically provide guidance. It may seem odd for a historian to warn against relying on historical analogies, but there are good analogies and those not so good. Every historical analogy must be examined to see if it sheds light on the situation at hand. And even when it sheds light, it will not provide a ready-made solution. When it comes down to it, there is no substitute for thinking through the options. President Bush will profit from studying 13 Days closely and absorbing Kennedy's mixture of caution and determination. Let's hope that he will always choose his historical analogies as carefully as President Kennedy did.
You've been listening to Michael Richards, professor of history at Sweetbriar College and a writer for the History News Service. Universe is Talking History.
Well, I'm satellite, baby, come on and go with me. Well, I'm satellite, baby, come on and go with me. It was never long as never stepped to them.
Summer has arrived, and along with it, opportunities to travel to some of the nation's nicest vacation spots. If you're looking for some historic sites along the way, perhaps we can recommend some to you during the next few months. Here to tell you about an interesting historical museum in the very popular Branson, Missouri, is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
If you're traveling west down Highway 76 in Branson, Missouri, don't be surprised if you see a full-sized World War II Mustang fighter plane standing 30 feet above the ground. It marks the location of the Veterans Memorial Museum of Branson. The museum contains five great halls that cover the five main wars and other conflicts fought during the 20th century. Each hall contains murals, artifacts, sculptures, and memorabilia honoring all branches of service, major battlefronts, and campaigns. The hallmark of the museum is a stunning 70-foot-long bronze sculpture consisting of 50 life-size soldiers running up a beach. The center of the Great Hall contains a wall that lists more than 400,000 names of men and women killed during World War II, and it is the only place in the world where all of the names are displayed. The museum is open 7 days a week.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, the History Channel will premiere a new and interesting series from June 25th through the 28th titled Empires of Industry. It will explore the history behind some of America's most important businesses. On June 25th, look for The Cola Wars, a history of the soft drink industry, a $100 billion business built on little more than sugar and water and, of course, daring and creative leadership. On June 26th, the series will take a look at the wildcat oilmen that flocked to Texas at the turn of the century, gambling everything to drill holes in the ground that could make them billionaires or bankrupt. On June 27th, Empire of Industry will explore the founding and flourishing of international air travel giants TWA and Pan Am. And on June 28th, the series will conclude with the history of the DuPont dynasty, the story of French immigrants who made a fortune selling gunpowder. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtimes of the History Channel series, Empires of Industry. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
That's why I'm marching. Yes, I'm marching. Marching down freedom's road. Ain't nobody gonna stop me. Nobody.